The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally, today we have David Grimm, editor for our online daily news site. He's here to talk about some recent stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on sex bias in research. When conducting an experiment, you try to have control over all sorts of things. Sometimes it's the room setup, like the lights or the temperature control, that kind of thing. Other times you have to control the subjects of the study, use genetically identical mice, say. All of this effort is to ensure that hopefully the only thing changing between one experiment and the next is the variable that you care about. But now there's something that might be kind of tough to change, the sex of the researcher. So, Dave, what were the first inklings that this might actually matter?
Well, this is a research team at McGill University in Montreal. They study pain, and their typical test subjects are mice and rats. And what they noticed is that the rodents sometimes seemed to feel less pain or seemed to be in less pain when a researcher was in the room versus a researcher not being in the room, even potentially the sight of a researcher. They did one experiment where there was actually a standee of Paris Hilton, and the mice seemed to feel less pain when this standee was in the room than when nobody was in the room.
What did the researchers do to see if the sex of the experimenter had anything to do with their research?
Well, this was sort of a nagging issue with them, and they said, well, let's see if we can get a bit more information on this issue. And they tried to replicate it, and sometimes they could replicate the effect, and sometimes they couldn't. And what they figured out was the effect, this analgesic effect, as they call it, only happened when male researchers were in the room versus female researchers.
They tried to tease apart whether or not the presence of a person mattered, and it got confusing because it mattered what sex they were.
That's right.
And they turned out that they didn't even need to just have a person. They could have other objects in place of that person.
That's right. They actually had the men and women in the lab wear some T-shirts, get them kind of stinky, and then put the T-shirts in the room. And then even with the male T-shirts in the room, that was enough to dull the pain in these rodents. And the researchers suspect that it's some sort of male scent chemical that's been conserved for potentially millions of years, because what they found is the scent of unfixed cats and dogs, males, and also other rodents also produced this effect. So it's something that's been with male mammals for a really long time.
And what might actually explain this effect? Why would mice care about the sex of these other organisms?
Well, the researchers think it's this really primordial response. Imagine you're a solitary mouse and you smell a male nearby. Chances are that male is up to no good. He's maybe defending his territory, or he's looking for food, or maybe he's looking to get into a fight. So that's going to make you kind of stressed out. And researchers have shown that when animals get stressed out, they're actually able to dull their pain response. It's evolutionarily advantageous to do that, because the less pain you're feeling, the more you're able to react to the situation at hand.
So now, this isn't something that scientists typically write down in their notebooks. I am a boy. I am testing on this mouse. Is this going to hurt reproducibility efforts?
Well, what's really significant about the study is there's decades of animal research, and this could impact not just pain research, but any types of animal behavior research. Things like, can monkeys do math? Or even human clinical trials. Can you imagine if you're getting an experimental drug and the administrator is a male? Are you going to feel less pain because of the drug or because it's a male? So this has potentially very wide-ranging impacts. Now, the researchers say we don't need to throw out decades of human and animal work, but what we really should do is start paying closer attention not to just what drug or experiment is being administered, but who's doing the administering.
Next up, we have a story on some deadly errors. Since the 1970s, the United States has executed more than 7,000 people. Very few would say that our court system is perfect, which means that some number of innocent people have been killed. Now, researchers have taken advantage of just how much scrutiny these types of cases get in order to make an estimate of the error rate for capital cases. So, Dave, what was the error rate? What do we think it was before the study was done? Was there even a reliable one out there?
No, and there was really a range of opinions. Some people really thought that there was very little error in death penalty cases, and some people thought there was a lot. But it was a really hard thing to put a number on.
This study attempted to look at false convictions in general, but narrowed the focus to death penalty cases. Why did they do that?
Obviously, there's a suspicion that a wide range of criminal cases result in false convictions. But it's really hard to get numbers on those cases because a lot of them aren't reported, a lot of them aren't heavily scrutinized. Versus death penalty cases, you have often a lot of appeals. They're actually recorded. All death penalty cases are recorded in a national database. So that data is available. And that's what the researchers did in this new study, is they actually went into that data, they combed through it, and they look for things like how often were these convictions overturned and what sort of mistakes were made. And they came up with a number of 4.1%, which means that, according to them, more than 4% of death row inmates may actually be innocent.
This false conviction rate is a lot higher than some people expected. Can this be applied to other types of convictions?
Well, the researchers say this number can't directly be extrapolated to other cases, but they suspect that you would see a similar figure if you looked at other criminal cases.
Does this study tell us anything about how to stop this from happening, about how to improve our error rate?
Well, unfortunately, we still don't know what's behind these false convictions. But now at least we've got a solid number to work with, and people can start maybe taking a fresher look at some of these issues.
Finally, we have a story on the difficulties of finding life on other planets. I don't know about you, but the amazing number of exoplanets that keep popping up makes me feel pretty hopeful about finding extraterrestrial life. But there are issues. Besides just listening for their radio stations broadcasting out to us, the options for detecting life on such faraway objects are pretty limited. Can you describe some of the basic methods we're using now, Dave?
Well, one of the main methods used now is to look for chemical signatures in the atmospheres of these alien worlds. And what they're looking for is a balance of certain gases. For example, a couple of gases that shouldn't exist side by side, because over time, one, because of chemical reactions occurring in the atmosphere, one would gradually disappear. The only way it wouldn't disappear is if you had organisms on the planet that were actively replenishing that gas. And so they've said, well, if we've got that mix, then that's a good sign that there may be alien life on that planet.
So we're looking for a special set of conditions. So, for example, like being in the habitable zone of a star or an unexpected combination of gases. What's the problem?
Well, the problem is with this gas problem. As you can imagine, researchers are looking at worlds that are very, very far away, light years and light years away. And what can happen sometimes is, even though they're trying to look at the atmosphere of that particular planet, if there's a moon very close by, they're going to capture the atmosphere of that moon as well. And say the moon has one of those gases that you're saying, well, that gas should sort of disappear over time. If the researchers don't know that the moon is there, they're going to say, well, there's a really nice balance of gases here. We've got a lot of X and we've got a lot of Y, so there must be organisms producing X or Y. When in fact what you have is you have the moon producing X and the planet producing Y, and it's giving you this false positive signal.
So how hard would it be to determine if this overlap phenomenon, looking at both the planet and its moon at the same time, how hard would it be to find out whether or not that was going on as opposed to a truly life-generated atmosphere?
With current technologies, it's very, very hard because, again, we're looking at planets that are very far away, and it's really hard to distinguish these two objects from each other.
What about more exotic life systems? So non-carbon-based life, things that live in gas planets. Are those even on the so-called radar for extraterrestrial life?
It's a great question, and there's so much mystery about what life would even look like if it existed beyond our solar system. What sort of gases it would even produce. But what's significant about this study is it allows us to at least take a skeptical eye against one of the factors that we've been considering as a sign of life. You obviously don't want to get your hopes up for life on an alien world if there could be a confounding factor there.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, speaking of scent, we've got a story about how humans can determine the gender of another person just from their scent alone. Also a story about why flies don't grow to be the size of houses. And we're all thankful for that. For Science Insider, we've got a story about a concerning report that's just come out of the World Health Organization suggesting that a lot of the harmful bacteria out there are rapidly evolving resistance to our antibiotics, and we may be getting closer to a post-antibiotic world. Also a story about why an Italian prosecutor is accusing a stem cell group of being a criminal organization. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.